Hey, Bruiser Buddies, this is Wrestling Nostalgia with Dave Dynasty.
Before we dive into the episode, make sure you hit subscribe on the podcast platform you're listening on. Also, follow me on X at The Dave Dynasty and subscribe on YouTube by looking up Nostalgic Dave Dynasty. You can also buy one of my shirts at ProWrestlingTees.com/TheDaveDynasty. Now, enjoy the show.
Welcome to 1 hour of the toughest, roughest wrestling you'll ever see.
That's right, Dick the Bruiser said it all.
The big question, have you got the endurance? Have you got the brains to get past the excellence of execution?
The reason why X and myself were put on this earth is to demolish people.
Bobby Heenan, that is a very good-looking sport coat you've got on.
Yeah, and I paid for mine. Mine isn't government issue.
Yellow, everybody. Lance Russell and Dave Brown right along ringside. By golly, we're ready to go with another big week of championship wrestling.
Greetings, wrestling fans, and welcome to Wrestling Nostalgia. I'm your host, Dave Dynasty. Thank you for joining me for another episode. On this episode, my guest is author Steve Johnson. He is the author of Jim Londos, the Golden Greek of Professional Wrestling. We're going to talk all about Londos, his importance to wrestling history, the book, and much more. So let's take a quick break and get right to it. And when we come back, we'll have my interview with Steve Johnson. So stick around.
Hey, you bums. We have to take a quick break.
Filsinger Games is a tabletop cards and dice game company that has enjoyed success for over 3 decades. Their first game was Champions of the Galaxy and was released in 1986. Champions of the Galaxy is a tabletop game that features professional wrestling over 100 years in the future. Humans, aliens, and monsters battle in the Galactic Wrestling Federation for belts. Legends of Wrestling features officially licensed wrestling cards featuring stars like Ted DiBiase, Jimmy Snuka, Harley Race, and many, many more, including game sets for independent promotions. Each match takes place in real time. The action is fast and furious, and all the things that happen in pro wrestling, like cage matches, outside interference, three-man tag matches, they also happen in the games. You have the opportunity to run your own wrestling promotion involving either real-life stars or fictional characters of the future, or you can mix and match both. Visit FilsingerGames.com for more information and to order the games today. That is Filsinger Games, FilsingerGames.com to order now. If you like horror movies, be sure to check out Dave Dynasty and Ike Isaacs on the Listen to Their Screams Horror Podcast. It is available on all podcast platforms and on social media at Listen to Screams. That is Listen, the number 2, and Screams. Hey ho, everybody. Subscribe to the Pinhead Pod, the Ramones fan podcast, bringing you interviews, news, deep dives, and much more. Look it up on your favorite podcast platform. That is Pinhead Pod.
We're back on Wrestling Nostalgia.
And welcome back to Wrestling Nostalgia. This time I'm being joined by Steve Johnson, author of Jim Londos, the Golden Greek of Professional Wrestling. Steve, how are you?
Well, I'm great, Dave, and thanks for having me on. I appreciate it. This is incredible timing in a way because we are talking here just a couple days before WrestleMania.
Yeah, that's right.
Which is the sine qua non, not just of sports entertainment, really, but of pop culture. But for the fact that Londos walked the face of the earth, we might be in a very different position with wrestling and WrestleMania.
That's right. And let's talk about Londos because a lot of people, I don't think some wrestling fans may have heard the name, but I don't think they fully grasp Jim Londos and his importance. And but let's begin at the beginning, right? Londos, he was born in Greece. And Londos is not his birth name, correct?
Correct. I can't even pronounce his name correctly. And in fact, it was spelled many different ways, but Christos Theophilou is about as close as you would get to having me say anything. And it's an amazing story because, as we know, it's an immigrant story as much as it is a wrestling story.
Sure. Yeah. Like you said, I mean, he came over right in his early teens.
Came over in his early teens. Can you imagine letting your 15-year-old go down the street without their cell phone in this day and age?
No,
No, but
much less move to a new country.
he's sailing across the Atlantic in steerage class for 3 weeks as a 15-year-old. And of course, we know the fate of ships that sailed across the Atlantic around that time was not always good. So that's kind of an amazing story in and of itself. But he comes to the United States at the age of 15, largely to escape the demands of what he considered to be a cruel and very difficult to work with father. And somehow, in this sea of immigrants, he ends up being the most famous athlete in the world in his time. So if you think of the odds of a 15-year-old from Greece, one of about 400,000 Greek immigrants coming to this country over about a 20-year period, and he's the one. He's the one. That's an amazing thing.
I think I read where you said, even if you take professional wrestling out of this, it's a fascinating story, even despite the wrestling, right? I mean, just the coming to the US and what he endured and to become a success. I mean, even if you don't dive into the professional wrestling career, it's a pretty remarkable human story.
Even for somebody who can come to the US as a 15-year-old immigrant and make a success of himself in that day and age, and coming to the country without necessarily a word of English and 20 bucks in his pocket, just to be able to establish a life here and live properly is kind of an amazing proposition. But he did that. So yeah, it is an amazing story just that he was able to do that part of it.
The things I've read and seen about his early life, there's always a mention of a cousin of his. Now, did his cousin come with him, or was his cousin already here in the US?
His cousin, Christos Gikos, was his name. He had come to the US previously and went back to Greece. So he was accompanied by someone, the contemporary, when he, excuse me, first came over here. But they soon parted ways as the cousin went to San Francisco and Landos, really the only way to describe it, is hoboed his way across the country.
And eventually winding up in San Francisco, right, where his cousin was, and worked odd jobs, did what he had to do. But while in San Francisco, kind of maybe a life-changing thing, right? He joined the YMCA,
He joined
and
the YMCA, and it was kind of a follow-up to his hobo travels across the country. His first real stop from New York was in Chicago, where he basically hung out with a couple of folks that he knew from Greece who were his age. They belonged to a gym, a club at a resettlement complex. And he would go over there, not working, he would go over there and kind of watch them during the day at the age of 15, 16. And that's where he first got involved in wrestling. He would watch these guys come over and wrestle in this gym, and he was taken by it. He'd come back home with his friends, throw a mattress on the floor, and try to replicate what he had seen during the day. So that's when the wrestling bug kind of bit him. So then, when he went to San Francisco, that's when he joined a Y and found out that he didn't know the first thing about wrestling. But he was a quick learner and a good athlete.
And quickly became a top amateur on the West Coast at that time.
That's one of the things that people don't realize. We didn't have at that point the kind of university or amateur wrestling that we do today, but he was in his teens, by any measure, the top light heavyweight amateur on the West Coast. So you wouldn't have all the laurels and the All-American honors that would go around with it today, but still, he was as good as anybody. Picked up the game really quickly, had a good build for this. Short, stocky, hard to move, built like a. Became a terrific amateur and one of the amateurs who became a professional. That was fairly unusual at that time.
And a rated turned pro around 1914. And he already there was already obviously, like you mentioned, the tensions with his father, but the turning into a professional wrestler was kind of a major split between him and his father, wasn't it?
Yeah, his father, for all intents and purposes, disowned him when he became a professional wrestler. Wasn't worthy of the family name. Professional wrestlers were bums, lowlifes. He wanted nothing to do with his son. Cut him off. That's a tough thing because Landis was the youngest of 13 children, although several died fairly young. So yeah. The father was disowning his youngest son because of his choice of careers. That's a difficult pill to swallow.
Yeah, and I would venture to guess, you know, obviously we can't get into his head, but I would venture to guess, right, that's a very driving force with what, yeah, you know, he became. I mean, I would have, I you know, the number one, maybe the urge to attempt to make his father proud, but also to prove him wrong.
That was one of the things, Dave, that I really didn't know about when I first got into this. When I started the book, I knew about Landis and about his record and kind of that sort of thing. I didn't really know anything about his personal life. Mm-hmm. It became apparent very quickly reading some of the things that he said, translating Greek newspapers, talking with his daughter, that the father-son relationship was absolutely essential to who he was, not just as a wrestler, but as a person. And it almost sounds like a, you know, Horatio Alger story, but he wanted to prove his dad wrong.
Yep.
And he was a burning, intense person to begin with, and he directed every energy he could to proving his dad that he could make something of himself, whether his dad approved of that or not. That went on for a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah, the secret sauce in there, in Landis's motivation, was trying to please his father.
Yeah, well, and also from what I've gathered, and I don't, you know, you can correct me if I'm wrong. I heard that I read that another kind of driving force was Landis was only what 5'8", and
five
lots
eight
of people, lots of people said he's
barely 200 pounds.
Yeah, so you know he had that, you know, at that time, that stigma of, you know, too small, too small, too small. And I mean, I think that from what I read could have been a motivating factor as well to prove those critics wrong.
Sure. He had the odds stacked against him in a lot of ways. We had the situation with his father. He had his size. He was a Greek immigrant at a time when the world champions basically were Joe Stecker and Ed Lewis and Frank Gotch, kind of the big all-American Midwestern farm boy types. A small Greek who did not speak particularly good English was not necessarily welcomed in that realm. So he was fighting a lot of things. And of course, the natural discrimination against a lot of South Europeans in the years following World War I. He had a lot of strikes against him, which makes his determination even more remarkable in my eyes. You know, every time we see somebody win a championship, whether it's football or basketball or, you know, the March Madness, first thing the reporter does is stick a microphone in front of the champion's face and say, you know, how did you get to this point? And the answer is, you know, it just took a lot of dedication. It just took a lot of hard work, you know, and it pays off in the end. I'm here to tell you, these guys were pikers compared to Landis when it came to dedication and hard work. There's no one who worked harder at his craft than he did. And that's a good lesson, not just from the 1920s, but for the 2020s as well, in terms of giving it that burning desire to be the best you can possibly be, given whatever you have to work with.
Yeah, and that, I mean, that work ethic, that drive, and coupled with, right, he, like you mentioned, the Greek thing, right? He did have a drive to, he wanted to become a world champion, you know, for Greece. That was a component of it as well. And all that, I mean, it worked, right? He won a few different versions of world titles in his career.
He did. The title situation back then was just as confusing as it was in the 70s or 80s. You know, there was world champions sprung up like flowers in the desert.
Yeah.
He became recognized through hard work and dint of sheer will as the world champion, never lost it. After he won it for the final time in 1938, he was, I think, one of the few wrestlers who retired as world champion and then never lost that again in a series of matches. That's important for his image. It's kind of the anti-Goldberg, right? He never lost that one match that sort of popped the balloon or deflated the ego. People have asked me all over the years studying Landis, so why didn't he drop more matches? And the answer is very simple. Then he wouldn't be Jim Landos. And Goldberg proved that, didn't he?
And like I mentioned, right, a lot of modern fans, they may have heard the name, right? And they may not know much, but they cannot grasp how big of a draw, an attraction he was from the 20s up, to the 50s or whatever. Perhaps, I mean, I think the argument can be made probably the biggest ever draw in professional wrestling, if you look at it closely, if you factor in inflation, if you look at the attendances. So what led to this Greek immigrant who was struggling, could barely speak English? What would you attribute? I mean, right, we've talked about the drive, the focus, but there has to be there. What led to him becoming this level of a draw?
I think there were really three things that I've kind of isolated. The first is right time and right circumstance. Okay. He was undersized and a Greek immigrant during the Depression. There is no better image for a worker who's down on his luck or out of money to see somebody who's his size get in there and battle against the odds, against guys who are much bigger than he is, and be able to come out on top. We talk about wrestling teaching you a life lesson. That is a life lesson. If he can go in there and defeat somebody or grapple with somebody using his brain power, as much as anything else. So I think he had an underdog appeal to folks of that era. And of course, that's continued on today. I said this elsewhere. I think Bryan Danielson is in the Jim Londos line. Excellent technical wrestler, undersized. You think he's going to get squashed every time he goes in there, but by dint of hard work, resourcefulness, and cleverness, he manages to come out on top. So there's always been a market for that. Secondly, he brought a new demographic to the matches. The Greek and ethnic fans, as well as female fans
Email. Yeah.
who
I was
were
going to bring
wild
that
about the
up.
body. Yeah, that's a big thing. He expanded the base of the wrestling fan, which was something that promoters stuck in the mud in the 1920s, as they were stuck in the mud for decades after that, didn't really realize there was an opportunity to expand their market.
Which very similar to the boom in the 80s, right? Where one of the biggest proponents in the 80s of the boom was let's get some good looking guys to draw in some of the female fans. And
Sure,
it
exactly.
helps, right? Yeah, I mean you're pulling off of a different demographic.
You
So
are. That's a critical element in bringing fans to the arenas. And then the other thing I think is just his style of wrestling was revolutionary for the time. Now, folks are going to go to YouTube and watch the three or four Landos matches we have on there, and they're still pretty good. They hold up 100 years later. But what you can't really capture is the way that he brought color to a black and white world. There's this image of guys from the early part of the 20th century wrestling in black tights, moving slowly, exchanging holds. Landis brought a new level of theatrics to matches. Not the kind of theatrics we think about today, where we were doing, top rope hurricane ranas onto a set of tables and then bouncing off a concrete block. But just his ability, which was part of his vaudeville training, to understand the connection between the performer and the artist. Lips pursed when he was in agony, reaching his hand out when he was in a difficult hold, as though he's trying to draw the people in the front row into his predicament. Making his comeback not with punches, but with counter holds. Again, getting back to resourcefulness. Those kinds of things just weren't done at that time, and they were borderline revolutionary. And then he introduced holds into wrestling like the sleeper hold. My goodness, what would wrestling be without the sleeper hold? You know, it's often imitated, never duplicated. So his style and his approach to the game was different, and it really resonated with people. And I think it still would today if you look back at seriously at some of the matches you can find on YouTube.
Yeah, I was going to say he was a bit of a bridge, right, between that old style and that new, right? He was the old, the old school wrestlers, the quote unquote shooters, and this and that, and what, not. I mean, I'm not doubting Landis was tough, right? Could whatever, and it was scrappy and was determined, and everything else. But you're right. I mean, he had that knew the importance of a performance, of a little bit some showmanship, and was introducing that even to that down to that what we talked about, that underdog story, right? That's it's. It's a story. It's a biblical story that everybody knows. The
Sure.
small underdog against the bigger giant, and it just and it worked. And I he did. I think he was one of the key components to help. You could spot a few handful of guys over the course of wrestling history that maybe kind of bent that timeline a little to point it in a new direction. And I think I think there's an argument to be made that yeah, that Landos was that guy that kind of started to point it in a new direction that later guys would take it and run with it. Some of those guys, right, the Gorgeous Georges, this and that, Londo's faced late in his career.
Yeah, what's really interesting, Dave, is that Landis was criticized at the time in the early part of his career for being too theatrical. This is not the way we conduct wrestling. My heaven, what is all this showmanship and this baloney that he's bringing into it? Yet, by the end of his career, when he's facing Gorgeous George and the French Angel and some of those characters, Primo Carnera, people are saying, "My God, what is this? What is this terrible wrestling? It's not like it was back in Landis's day. He's the lone paragon of virtue in wrestling." It gets back to what our friend Dave Meltzer has always said: every generation criticizes the wrestling that was before it, saying it was not as good. So that's when you turn to the drawing power and you look at his drawing power and you say, "My goodness, audiences didn't just increase when he first came on the scene." They doubled, they tripled, they quadrupled. He drew the biggest crowds in certain arenas in the 30s until WrestleMania, 50 years later. He must have had something going for him, and he did. It's just a shame that in today's era where we move on so quickly from whatever happened on last night's AEW Dynamite, that we don't always take the time to realize, wow, this was really something back then, and it still holds lessons for us today.
Yeah, I mean he helped establish New York wrestling pre-McMahon era, right? And then once he kind of left New York, right, it kind of fell apart until McMahon because they didn't have him. And he's
It didn't just fall apart when he left New York in the 30s. They didn't have wrestling in Madison Square Garden for 11 years. So yeah, that's bottom barrel. When he first when he won his first championship, they didn't even run Madison Square Garden. Jack Curley at the time, the two or three times before Landis won his first championship in 1930, they ran the Garden with Ed Lewis or Joe Stecker as champion, and they're drawing crowds of 2,000, 3,000, 4,000. Landis is champion. All of a sudden, people are ripping the railings apart at the Garden trying to get in, and we're at 20,000. And it's becoming such an event that's newspapers that previously treated wrestling like at arm's length to be charitable are suddenly saying, "What is this great phenomenon? Who is this guy?" And he's becoming not just a wrestling icon, he's becoming a pop culture icon. He was in that sense the first of the way we see the crossover wrestling icons of today. And he's all doing this when he's an immigrant from Greece, really the first immigrant athletic superstar in the US. The field was limited because you couldn't, the color line in baseball and football and so forth. But he really was the first immigrant to have major athletic success in the US.
Yeah, and it made him a hero back home in Greece, because talking drawing, right? When he went back to Greece for a match, right? There's talks of, we're talking, what, the number is 100,000. I mean,
We
in to
spent,
see.
a lot of time on that. In suffice to say that in Greece, he moved from hero status to deity status. The country had been through some hard times in the teens and the 20s, and Landis was something of a savior. And I know it's funny to use the idea of a wrestler as a savior for a nation, but if you go back at the Greek newspapers of that time, and I thank Vicky Moutsouri of Athens, who helped me go through all those papers and conduct the research, it's just amazing the way Greece associated Landis with its national success and its national identity, to the point where prime ministers sought him out for photo opportunities, hoping to get a little bit of the rub from Landis. And so you see prime ministers of Greece saying that, Venizelos saying that Landis is a beacon of light in troubled times. Or in 1937, in his famous match in the Olympic Stadium with Johannes van der Walt, Landis walks into the stadium accompanied by the Greek prime minister. That's almost unfathomable to us that he had that kind of stature in his native land, and not just in Greece, but in Cyprus and in Egypt and South Africa and England and France and Turkey and all the other places that he wrestled internationally. He was just the biggest drawing card in the US, but he was truly kind of the wrestling representative to the world.
And he seemed to have a good grasp on his power and influence, because he was very philanthropic, right? He was very giving, very helpful, to the point, right, of being recognized in Greece and being recognized by R Richard Nixon for his deeds. So it's one of those things where it's good to see, right, someone come from where he came, get to that level, and not forget. And to, be giving, but especially for Greece, right? He did a lot for Greece, and was
He did a lot
recognized.
of, yeah, he was, he made a lot of money, he gave a lot of money away. One thing I didn't put it down in the book, because it was almost too humble, but it's an important story. So Landis bought land in Southern California for cash in the 30s that turned into his avocado and lemon farms. And he brought the property at that time inexpensively, and of course, property in Southern California in those lush hills became amazingly exorbitantly expensive. But he gave a lot of down and out wrestlers who didn't have a job, or maybe they were past their prime, jobs on his farm to help them out when they needed a buck here or there. So not only was he philanthropic in terms of wrestling for charitable organizations and giving away money that earned him commendations from the King of Greece and President Nixon and others, but just on a personal level, he helped out an awful lot of people. And there's a story in the book where he was wrestling in Canton, Ohio, which is really where he got his big start in the 1910s, and learned of the plight of a young man at ringside whose stepfather was out of work, and the young man was just peddling newspapers to try and support his family. And Landis gave him half of his $2,000 payday for the night. And the young man subsequently wrote about it, and I was fortunate to find that description of that, but he said he could never forget Jim Landis for the what he did on the spur of the moment out of his own pocket. So yeah, we think of wrestlers as kind of a cold-hearted, flinty bunch, and some champions of the immediate past come to mind when we say that, but there was a human side to Landis, and it surely was rooted in the fact that people reached out to him and helped him along the way from the time he arrived at Ellis Island until he became world champion.
Yeah, and there's again, it's such a, I mean, a fascinating career, a fascinating life. So many of these stories, but what, obvious besides the obvious fact that the book on Jim Londos, it needed to be written. What finally was the turning to make you decide to write this book?
The real key was John Kapuya's book on Gorgeous George, which most folks have looked at or read. John's not been in the best of health, but he wrote a wonderful book on Gorgeous George. The problem is George's ending is not pretty. He battled alcoholism. His star skyrocketed very quickly, but tumbled to earth very quickly. It's not the kind of thing you make a Disney movie out of, in short. Landis is kind of the opposite of that. He worked hard. He had a long career. He saved his money. He helped others. And he had the admiration of so many people. So I saw Landis as kind of the contrast to Gorgeous George, not flashy with the robes, although he was flashy in his own way. But respecting the business, respecting himself, taking care of himself physically, and raising a wonderful family. In many ways, and that's not to demean Gorgeous George, but in many ways, kind of the story arc is very, very different. And that was what really got me thinking about, we need to write about this guy. We write about a lot of wrestling failures, and here is probably the greatest success story in the history of this sport. In fact, I'll go strong. This is the greatest success story in the history of this sport. I'll die on that hill. This needs to be captured. Now, that took a lot of work, primarily because I don't read Greek or speak Greek, so I did have a wonderful translator and researcher who helped me with that. Because the story is as much about Greece in the end as it is about North America.
Yeah, I was going to ask about your research, right? Because it's difficult to write about someone who's, no longer with you, with us, that we can, where you can't get that firsthand story. You can't reach out to them. But you said that, right? You had some input and some cooperation from his family and his daughters.
Right.
And then you said that you had someone in Greece helping you with the newspaper thing. And then that, I mean, that's pretty crucial, right? To do that. But, and the one, I guess, correct me if I'm wrong here, from what I've, my research and my things I've seen, and I don't typically go back quite as far as with my research as, on things as you did with Landis, but the newspaper coverage was very different on professional wrestling. And you would get coverage of the big matches lots of times in the major cities and stuff. So I mean, I'm venturing to guess that that helped. Did like you said, did once you made contact with the family and you found someone, a Greek contact, did things dramatically get easier for you, or did you still have some hurdles with trying to research him?
Things got more difficult in the sense that I had more stuff to work with. I could have written, 120,000 words about Landis. It's 80,000 as it is. So trying to trim it down and keep it at a level where somebody who's not necessarily a wrestling fan can enjoy the story was a little bit of a hurdle. But I also hit just about every library known to man, including Notre Dame, where they have such a great wrestling collection there. So weaving together all those strands kind of got me to where I was. The example I use that I don't think has appeared in any other book on wrestling is that I have quoted the Journal of Ophthalmology here after I did some research with them and found Landis's case study of trachoma in some of the medical journals of the 1920s. Now that's digging in deep, but to bring that around, Landis suffered from trachoma, like a lot of wrestlers did at the time, because of dirty mats. And untreated, that can lead to blindness. And he was very fearful that his career was going to be nipped in the bud because of that. So, yeah, that's going the extra mile, but it turned out that that was a very important element of his story. So multiply that by a lot of little things that you just kind of tugged at the string and tugged at the string, and all of a sudden you unraveled something. And that's the way I tried to approach the research for this. And I'm a journalist by trade, an old newspaper reporter. So I naturally doubt anything I'm told to begin with, which is that's
Well,
doubly so with wrestling.
yeah, really. And when you made contact with the family, did Londos keep any journals or booking calendars? Did they have anything like that to help fill in some things? Because I know you obviously a lot of wrestlers have that, but sometimes they're lost to time because people don't see the importance of these things.
Yeah, there was no spiral bound day-to-day record of where he was or what he was doing, but there were some elements there in some miscellaneous papers of he wrestled in such and such a city one night and his payoff was this or that, and by that you're kind of able to extrapolate things beyond that. There were speeches that he had written because he gave a lot of public speeches later in his life about the importance of physical culture and the importance of physical training. And the really interesting find, and I mentioned it in the book, were his income tax returns from 1919 and 1920. Now, remember, this is just after the federal income tax had started in the US. So these were very early income tax returns. I think for 1919, he reported an income of wrestling of $1,750. That was it. That's probably more by today's standards, but I think even by 1919's measures, he was not exactly getting rich, going in every night and getting beaten to a pulp before he made his comeback.
So, and when you went through the research and talking to the family, working with the contact in Greece, did you through this course, was there anything, maybe just one in particular, but multiple if you need to, was there any real major surprises besides you mentioned the tax returns? Was there anything that just was a major surprise that you uncovered that you couldn't believe, or maybe defied some of the stories out there, or unearthed something that maybe wasn't? I mean, I'm sure there was plenty of things like that, but was there anything that really jumped as you as a major point that you unearthed?
One of the things that I really didn't realize is that he sort of invented his own territory system. This guy was a smart businessman. He didn't have he had probably the equivalent of an eighth grade education, but he's a lifelong reader, enjoyed reading, studied the philosophers, and so forth. But he was a shrewd businessman, and he would work with promoters, often Greek promoters, to open up a town, a city, or a state, and take a cut of that operation. That's, that became a practice that we understood existed in the 60s when maybe Vern Gagne owned the AWA or Dick the Bruiser controlled Indianapolis or Chicago or Eddie Graham put himself on top in Florida. But Londos was decades ahead of that in looking for a city to operate, to open up, or to pop business, working with various promoters, again, Greek, John Kontos, Tom Pax were probably the main ones. And I didn't realize probably the business side of things. He went to Memphis 17 times over a 2 or 3 year period, which is a lot of appearances even back in those days. But he was setting up John Kontos and Charles Rentrop in the Memphis business. And he replicated that across the country in various places. So I wasn't prepared to realize how smart he was in trying to expand the base of wrestling at a time when the biggest promotional effort was to stick a sign outside an arena and say, wrestling here tonight, 8 p.m.
Yeah, I mean, it very much sounds like he had an understanding of go where some money is, right? Where no one else is, no one's been there, right? And there's would probably be a desire for that. Yeah, that's very ahead of its time.
It
And
was. I really wasn't prepared to realize how shrewd he was in terms of the wrestling business. And Dave, you had to be in that day and age because when you were in there against the promoters of that era, guys like Toots Mont and Billy Sandow, you had to throw elbows,
Sure.
because if you didn't, their elbows would floor you. And it was a rough and tumble business, but it was one that he saw an opening in a lot of areas and took it. And business prospered under him like it never had prospered before and has seldom done so since. And I just add, he did this without social media. He did this without TV. He did this without Instagram. He did this without the backing of a publicly owned company. He did this without an AEW or a WWE or the NWA. Now, he did this essentially on his own for most of his career until he hired a business manager named Ed White. So to be able to self-promote and do all those things while keeping yourself in shape and going from town to town on the train and wrestling and winning, he led a full life at that time.
Sure. So what ultimately led to Londo's retiring? Was it just purely an age, mostly an age type thing, or
It
were
really
there
was, yeah, it really was an age type thing. His last set of matches was in 1959 in a tour of Australia and New Zealand. And he was 65 years old at the time. It was a series of charity matches. And the papers, the accounts of the matches at the time make it clear that his time had passed. He wasn't moving as quickly or as agilely as he had in the past. It took him a while to catch his breath after matches. So it really was another wrestler who just couldn't get it out of his system and did it for as long as he possibly could. Even then, though, he had a special attraction. I talked to Stan Kowalski, who was on that tour with him, the Big K, wrestled him several times in that. Stan was the brawler of all brawlers, right? There was in the ring, there was not a nice bone in his body. But he said, and I thought this was important, that you didn't go in to a match and punch Londos. That was disrespecting him. You didn't, he was above that. You went in and you wrestled him. Even if you were the meanest heel in the world, you went in and wrestled him and didn't use the kind of tactics that we would associate with wrestlers coming on later. So even at 65, slowed down at the end of his career, he still commanded a level of respect from the other wrestlers that actually dictated the flow of a match. That's pretty remarkable when you come to think about it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I encourage people to go read the book, right? I don't want you to tell every story, but I think we gave a good sampling here to get to hopefully people to understand the importance of Jim Londos. A, but then to maybe get that craving going, for them to go get the book. What's next for you said you were a reporter, you're a writer by nature. What's next for Steven Johnson, the author? Do you have any future projects planned or?
In terms of wrestling, we do. Of course, I have some other stuff outside of wrestling that pays for the wrestling research and wrestling writing, because nobody gets rich writing books on Jim Landis. But I have another book coming out within the next probably a couple of months, called Mirth, Mayhem, and Mad Men, which is a collection of some of the pieces from Slam Wrestling that I've done, updated and refreshed. And there's also a bunch of new things in there as well, on Dr. Jerry Graham and the IWA and Bobby Manigault and some other things that are kind of cool. The book follows the mold of the Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame series that Greg Oliver and I did. And then, fingers crossed, the next major book, maybe a ways off, but is on the French Angel, Maurice Tillet,
Oh, yeah. There you go.
wrestling's first curiosity draw, and another guy who really crossed into pop culture, in part because of his wrestling, but in part because of his appearance. Really remarkable story, and some believe he was even the inspiration for
Or
Shrek.
Shrek. Yeah, I was gonna say, yeah, even a modern, such a modern impact that people may not even realize, right? I mean, and I can see that if you compare. I can see where the inspiration would be there. It makes sense. So all right. So some exciting stuff coming there. Do you have a way that listeners can follow you to keep track of those projects,
Sure.
as they develop?
On Twitter or X or whatever we're calling it these days, it's Steel Belt Steve.
Okay.
You can always look for our stories at Slam Wrestling. I just wrote a piece a couple of weeks ago on the late Dave Cameron, which was great. I'm on Facebook. You shouldn't have to work too hard to find me. Or you can just Google me.
Yeah, there you
My
go.
name appears. All the contact information for this book is at an easy URL, londosbook.com, which has some stories that we didn't touch on today and some other information, but there's ordering information there and contact information if someone wants to reach out. I always thought at this point in my life I'd be looking for ways for people not to contact me, but I try to respond to everybody, good, bad, or indifferent. And having things like this, Dave, helps. I appreciate it.
Well, of course. And once again, the book is Jim Londos, the Golden Greek of Professional Wrestling. Steve said, right? Londosbook.com, kind of a central hub for that. But it's also available from all your prominent book retailers, on
Sure.
Amazon, etc., if that's your preferred choice. It's easily accessible, easy to get. And I would highly encourage people to go out there and to read that. And lots of people, if you're a modern wrestling fan and perhaps with an interest in the history and kind of want a starting point, right? Where should I look? What's something that can kind of vault me off? This would be a very good starting point, right, with Jim Londos, because like I said, he's very much a bridge to modern wrestling, and you can kind of see where modern wrestling stems from him. So I think this would be a good starting point for people. So go get the book. Steve, I appreciate your time, and we'll revisit and have you back on in the future when you ha have some other projects out there, especially at French Aid. That's exciting. I look forward to that. And we'll talk again when you have some other future projects and discuss those.
Well, thanks for having me on, Dave. I greatly
Sure.
appreciate it. Follow your stuff and
Well, thank you.
I wish you the best for this.
Thank you. Yeah, like I said, I wanted to give everybody kind of an overview of Londos today, and without giving away the whole farm, and to hopefully, like I said, to encourage people to spark enough interest for people to go and buy the book and dive in, because you told a few stories today, but that's just the tip of the iceberg of what they can get from the book. So that's what I want. I want people to go dive deeper and buy the book. So go look it up, guys. Again, Steve, thank you for your time, and we'll talk again in the future about some of your other projects coming up.
Thank you, Dave.
Hey, you bums, we have to take a quick break.
Hey guys, Ray Russell here, curator of the WrestleCopia Podcast Network, inviting you guys to listen to many of the programs here as part of the WrestleCopia brand, including, but not limited to, the Wrestling Memory Grenade, currently covering the 1988 and the WWF project. You can also listen to the Regional Wrestling Podcast, where we talk the territories, whether it's Jamie Ward with Georgia 81, Roman Gomez with the UWF in 1986, or Gene Jackson covering Memphis in 85. Three projects going on right now over there at Regional Wrestling. You can also listen to the Wrestling Stoop with the legend himself, Bob Roop. Bob goes back in time each and every week, covering not just his career, but countless stories and interactions with hundreds of wrestling names spanning his two decades in the business. But that's not all. You can also check out the Puro Wrestling Academy with the professor of Puro Resu, Mr. Dan Ginnity. Dan and I go back in time and cover the history of Japanese professional wrestling in the English language. And you can listen to all of those shows and more, all part of the WrestleCopia Podcast Network, located over at WrestleCopia.com. That's WrestleCopia.com, and anywhere your podcast streaming needs are met. From Apple to Spotify, Pocket Cast, and beyond. And while you're at it, why not subscribe to our social media guys for all the latest goings on here at the WrestleCopia Podcast Network? Plus, I'm constantly adding old school video clips and pictures from throughout wrestling history. You can follow us over on X, formerly Twitter, at Wrestling Grenade. That's at R-A-S-S-L-I-N Grenade. Also, follow and like me, Facebook.com/Wrestling Grenade. And why not subscribe to YouTube.com/Wrestling Grenade. So if you're looking to support that next up-and-coming podcast brand, please consider making it WrestleCopia.
Hey, it's Bob Smith, and guess what? The Outdated Wrestling Hour is now part of the WrestleCopia Podcast Network. But hey, no fear, you're still going to hear the unique guests, comedy, music, authors, journalists, funny people. Who knows who's going to end up on the Outdated Wrestling Hour? Remember, it's all new and all old. So check it out in the WrestleCopia Podcast Network and wherever you get your podcasts. Listen if you know what's good for you.
Hey everybody, Gene Jackson here, inviting you to check out the Retro Wrestling Review, where each week I'm joined by some great co-hosts who help me review classic episodes of USWA Championship Wrestling, and right now we are doing week-by-week reviews of 1993. But we don't just do reviews, sometimes we get a chance to interview some of the people who were there and lived it, plus do watch-alongs. It's a lot of fun, so check out new episodes that drop every Wednesday at WrestleCopia.com. And to find links to everything associated to the podcast, you can go to uswapodcast.com.
We're back on Wrestling Nostalgia.
All right, and thank you to Steve for coming on the show and talking to us about Jim Londos and his book. Guys, go out and get that book. There will be a link in the show notes to take you straight to Amazon to buy his book. You're going to want to read it. Jim Londos is a very important figure in wrestling history. So go buy the book and dive a little deeper. Also, make sure you go follow me on social media. I'm on pretty much every platform. All you have to do is look up Nostalgic Dave Dynasty or at The Dave Dynasty, all one word, and you will probably find me. Also, go check out all the other WrestleCopia Network podcasts. You can find them by searching on your favorite podcast platform or go to WrestleCopia.com. Also, be sure to check out my friends at the Ultimate Classic Wrestling Library. Go to classicwrestling.net to sign up for the most affordable wrestling streaming service available, and then you can download the Ultimate Classic Wrestling app on all of your smart devices. My guest next episode will be Sergeant Buddy Lee Parker. We'll talk all about WCW, the Power Plant, and much more. That is coming up next week. Thank you for following me and all your interactions on social media. It is very much appreciated. And guys, remember, wherever you go and whatever you do, be good, be safe, and always keep on growing.
Fans, we brought you All-Star Championship Wrestling. This is Sam Manager thanking you for being with us and saying until next time, so long, everyone.
Wrestling Nostalgia, copyright Dave Dynasty, Bruiser voice done by John Lawson.